contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the How to Build a Life section of the magazine, and is entitled The Key to Good Parent-Child Relationship, Low Expectations, by Arthur Brooks. Young people are high-minded, for they have not yet been humbled by life, not have experienced the force of necessity. Nor have they experienced the force of necessity. Aristotle wrote in Rhetoric, they think they know everything and confidently affirm it. When people my age complain about kids these days, they are often taking an indirect swipe at their own young adult children. I can just imagine Aristotle's son, Nicomachus, must have felt in return in what he felt. Dad probably dispensed unwelcome advice. No one will ever hire you if you go around with your kalamis hanging off like a common delinquent. Made Nicomachus feel guilty. Why would you? Would it kill you to visit poor Proxenus now and then? Treated him like he didn't know anything. I wrote the Nicomachean Ethics. You should have a peek at it. And raised topics he didn't want to talk about. I hear both sides of this story in my work. My research focuses on happiness in the second half of life, and I teach happiness to young adults. What I hear from them matches the broader lessons from research on parent-child relationships. They are one of the most important contributors to the well-being of both generations. When they're good, they're great. Young adults and their parents perceiving their relationship as good has been associated with low psychological distress and high life satisfaction. But they can also be one of the most strained bonds in a parent's or child's life. Whether you're a parent, an adult child, or both, you have the power to make things more harmonious and reap all the benefits of a strong bond. To achieve that, you must do something counterintuitive but simple. Lower your expectations. Neither parents nor adult children have to be perfect for the relationship to be satisfying and healthy. With lower expectations, you can break out of your childhood dynamics and form a bond based on mutual respect as adults. Even in the best of situations, tension between adult generations in a family is normal. In one pair of researchers' words, many parent-child bonds are frayed by the give-and-take between autonomy and dependence and the tension between concern and disappointment. One common source of tension stems from the misalignment between how adult children and their parents view their relationship and their roles that they each play. In other words, mismatched expectations. Parents may think that the relationship is more harmonious and enjoyable than their adult kids think it is, while grown children may view the benefit of the bond in terms of exchanges of assistance. In Aristotelian terms, you might say that parents see the relationship as more intrinsic. The kids see it as more instrumental. Meanwhile, children tend to think that they are doing more to help their aging parents think than their aging parents think they are. And fathers report higher levels of involvement in the relationship than the adult children's perceive. All of this can create involvement in the relationship. All this can create resentment, which is the only natural when people you love fail to meet your expectations. It is all the worse when the other party doesn't even seem to notice. Other areas of unrest, unmet expectations, are common as well. Adult children can seem unambitious to parents who struggle to make ends meet early on. They might forego marriage or children to their parents' disappointment or disapproval. Parents might withdraw financial support in a way that seems selfish to grown kids, or appear more interested in their own lives than those of their children and grandchildren. The most extreme form of unmet expectation is a values breach in which the adult child rejects something about the parents' core beliefs. This can rupture the relationship entirely and is strikingly common. Researchers writing in the Journal of Family and Marriage in 2015 found that about 11% of mothers ages 65 to 75 with at least two grown children were totally estranged from at least one of them. They found that a values conflict was at the root of many of these estrangements, while the violation of social norms, for instance, dropping out of high school, usually was not. For adult children, this means that your mother or father probably cares more about what you believe and how you express it than how you live. Waiting for your parent or child to get their act together is probably not a recipe for success in your relationship. Research shows that many parent-child relationships remain strained as everyone involved ages, a phenomenon partly explained by a theory known as developmental schism hypothesis. Taking action is important. I recommend employing the following three strategies, which curtail three common harmful patterns. 1. Don't try to read minds. As the years go by, many families fall into a tendency to assume that communication need not be spoken, that everyone understands one another without saying anything. This is an invitation to miscommunication. Evidence shows that it's best to have a clear family policy of speaking for yourself and listening to others. One way to do this is with regular family meetings, where each of you can air issues that are on your mind before they fester into a major problem or misunderstanding. The key isn't asking anyone to change their reactions to your actions or feelings. It's to give them the chance to hear your side of things and respond before you start assuming that you know what their response will be. 2. Live your life, but don't ask them to change their values. Estrangement within families is a tragedy, perhaps inevitable in the cases of abuse, but avoidable in so many clashes of pride. You have to decide yourself whether a schism is warranted, but as the study above suggests, aging parents are likelier to accept lifestyle choices that they disagree with than to accept their kids telling them that their values are wrong, which they might perceive as a personal rejection. Perhaps this sounds morally inconsistent or even hypocritical, but it isn't. I hold a lot of values that I do not share with loved ones. I can still coexist permanently with these differences of opinion without feeling hurt or angry, precisely because I don't expect anyone else to change their mind, and because I don't insist on agreement. There is no reason to fight. 3. Don't treat your family like emotional ATMs. When people treat their family as a one-way valve of help and advice, usually parents giving and children receiving, the resentment tends, ironically, to go both ways. Visits and calls become tiresome, repetitive interviews instead of conversations. My belief is that this stems from a stunted development in the relationship. For example, perhaps mom and dad still treat you like a youngster. Meanwhile, you rarely or never ask about their lives or take a true human interest in them. Rather than expecting your family members to be bottomless fonts of help and wisdom, or to learn to stop giving you unsolicited advice all the time, take the lead by treating your family the way you do your friends, both generously giving and gratefully accepting emotional support. Research shows that the relationship can be greatly enhanced when adult children and their parents treat each other as individuals with past histories and limitations. In other words, as peers. If your relationship with your parents or adult kids is especially difficult, working to improve it might feel like a lost cause. But giving up would almost certainly be a mistake, because those people are either your past or future self. According to the behavioral geneticist Robert Plowman, our cognitive skills, interests, and personality traits all tend to resemble our parents more and more as we age. As a young man, I thought I was quite different from my father. Now I hear his voice almost every time I open my mouth. Your kids provide a rare glimpse of your past, your parents of your future. Giving that up means losing insight into yourself, which is a lost opportunity to gain self-knowledge and to make progress as a person. Lowering your expectations and loving them despite their faults may be the best investment you'll ever make. next. I consider this a technology plus opinion, a piece entitled "You Don't Know How Bad the Pizza Box Is" by Sahil Desai. Pizza delivery, it turns out, is based on a fundamental lie. The most iconic delivery food of all time is bad at surviving delivery, and the pizza box is to blame. "I don't like putting any pizza in a box," Andrew Bellucci, a legendary New York City pizza maker of Andrew Bellucci's Pizzeria, told me. "That's just it, really. The pizza degrades as soon as it goes inside, turning into a swampy mess. A pizza box has one job, keeping a pie warm and crispy during its trip from the shop to your house, and it really can't really do it. The fancier the pizza, the worse the results. A slab of overbaked Domino's will probably be at least semi-close to whatever its version of perfect is by the time it reaches your door. But a pizza with fresh mozzarella cooked at upwards of 900 degrees? Forget it. Sliding a $40 pie into a pizza box is the packaging equivalent of parking a Lamborghini in a wooden shed before a hurricane." And yet the pizza box hasn't changed much, if at all, since it was invented in 1966. Then, boxes were shallow cardboard squares with flaps to lock them into place. Today, the boxes are shallow cardboard squares with flaps to lock them into place. You'll see the same design both in dinky spots for drunken college students and in the country's most sought-after Neapolitan joints. Since the introduction of this corrugated vessel, humanity has landed on the moon, rolled out the internet, created cell phones, and invented a combination air fryer instant pots. But none of that matters. Ye old pizza box refuses to die. The problem with the pizza box starts with the pie itself. Let's consider what makes the pizza so perfect. Not the alchemy between sauce and cheese, but the texture. A classic hot pizza will have a tender and gooey center with a crust that's as dry and crispy as an eggshell. Even a single slice of freshly cooked budget pizza can deliver a textural kaleidoscope that is unparalleled for its price. None of these qualities fare well in a box. Unlike a Tupperware of takeout chicken soup or palak paneer, which can be microwaved back to life after its journey to your home, the texture of a pizza starts to irreparably worsen after even a few minutes of cardboard confinement. You'll never get a pizza out of a box that tastes as good as it would have before it went in. Scott Weiner, New York pizza tour guide and author of Viva la Pizza, The Art of the Pizza Box, told me. The basic issue is this: a fresh pizza spews steam as it cools down. A box traps that moisture, suspending the pie in its own personal sauna. After just 5 minutes, Weiner said, the pie's edges become flaccid and chewy. Sauce seeps into the crust, making it soggy. All the while, your pizza is quickly losing heat. After 15 minutes, the cheese has congealed into dollops of rubber. And after 45 minutes, your pizza deteriorates into something else entirely. It'll be chewy and dry at the same time, Anthony Falco, a pizza consultant and author of Pizza Czar, told me. And there's nothing you can do about it. How to get a hot pizza from the oven to your doorstep is a centuries-old dilemma. When pizza was merely winter sustenance for paupers in 19th-century Naples, pies were loaded into stufas, copper containers that young lads would balance on their heads. Things got weird fast when pizza made its way to the U.S. At Lombardi's in New York City, perhaps the country's first pizzeria, lore has it that lukewarm pies were rolled up with twine and reheated on factory furnaces by famished laborers. After World War II, when to-go pizza began to take flight, we finally got the progenitor of the pizza box, flimsy cardboard containers similar to today's birthday cake boxes. By 1949, when the Atlantic sought to introduce America to the pizza, the package was already something to lament. You can take a pizza home in a paper box and reheat it, but you should live near enough to serve it within 20 minutes or so. People do reheat pizza, which has become cold, but it isn't very good. The cheese may be stringy and crust-like, crust rock-like at the edges, soggy on the bottom. And then came the modern pizza box. In 1966, the owner of a small Michigan pizza chain called Domino's enlisted a local packaging company to construct a box out of corrugated cardboard that would better withstand takeout and delivery. Think about any recent Amazon box you've gotten in the mail, and you'll see what makes this box different. Corrugation produces a layer of wavy cardboard between a top and bottom sheet, sort of like a birthday cake. The design creates thick, airy walls that protect the precious cargo within a pizza box and insulate the pie's heat while also allowing some steam to escape. This new take on the box ushered in a takeout pizza revolution. It was a pleasure to hand one to a customer and feel confident that it wouldn't sag open and drop the pizza on his porch, Tom Monahan, Domino's founder, wrote in his 1986 autobiography, at which point the chain already had several thousand stores worldwide. And these boxes do have a lot going for them. They are dirt cheap to mass produce, can stack on top of one another without compromising the pizza within, ship flat to nestle into cramped shops, and are deceptively easy to fold. We've gotten a couple of pizza delivery innovations in the past few decades: the insulated heat bag, that ubiquitous Velcro duffel bag used to keep pizzas warm on their journey, those mini plastic table things, and, well, that's mostly it. No pizza box in widespread use today is significantly better at keeping a pizza fresh than the one Domino's invented all those years ago. Indeed, if any pizza holds up well in the old-fashioned box, it's the chain variety. These pies run drier to avoid a case of the pizza slops. But there is a lot more to pizza than Domino's and Pizza Hut. With no better options, some pizzerias are now rejiggering their recipes to better survive the box, dropping their own oven temperatures and adding the cheese beneath the sauce. Every single pizza that I put in a box, I know, is going to be, let's say, at least 10% not as good as it could have been, Alex Plattner, owner of Cincinnati's St. Francis of Pisa, told me. Others dream of better days. After smoking a lot of weed, I have come up with a lot of ideas for a better box, says Bellucci, the New York City pizza maker. If there is a single food item poised for some technological ingenuity, it's pizza. When the pandemic wrecked the restaurant industry in 2020, pizza sales managed to tick up. Billions of pizzas are delivered in this abomination of a box every year. In other words, the pizza box is a market failure that is screaming to be, well, disrupted. We are simply eating a worse version of one of the most popular foods around, all because of the deficiencies of something that seems so eminently fixable. The thing is, though, an improved box exists. There are products out there that are better, says Weiner, but all of them have problems. Just about all boxes are the common corrugated kind, but a few special and honest attempts have been made to move beyond it. Some of them are weird prototypes. I have an inflatable pizza box from Denmark, Weiner said. Corporate America and garage inventors alike have sought to pioneer a better box. In 2015, one cash-flush Silicon Valley startup, Zoom, created the Pizza Pod, a round two-piece spaceship of a container made from compressed sugarcane fiber. Let a pizza sit inside it, and the fibers will absorb the errant moisture better than cardboard, keeping the pie crisp. Last year, the German brand PeaceCycle debuted the Tupperware of pizza containers, a reusable vessel studded with ventilation holes on its side. Even Apple, has patented its own round pizza box exclusively for its famished Cupertino office workers. And perhaps the most ingenious container I've found is from an Indian company called Ventit. The box takes the normal corrugated vessel and thins out part of the cardboard at the top and bottom, creating venting channels that, at least according to Ventit's own research, achieve something miraculous: reducing steam inside the box by an additional 25%, while while also maintaining the pizza's temperature. So we know it's not a question of ingenuity. We can construct better pizza boxes, and we already have. The real issue is cost. No superior pizza box can come close to matching the price of a simple corrugated cardboard, and in the restaurant industry with such tight margins, the math is hard to deny. The problem is that everybody expects this box, and nobody is too offended by it, Viner says. There hasn't been enough push for something different. For now, we're still waiting for the perfect box, one that is as cheap, stackable, foldable, and sustainable as its corrugated brethren. When all factors are considered, corrugated cardboard has proven to be the best available material. For packaging pizza, John Quarle, a pizza packaging inventor with 43 patents, told me over email, for years other materials have been suggested and tried, but they each have problems. There are other issues, too. Five companies control 70% of the cardboard market in the U.S., a level of consolidation that is rampant across the American economy. Independent pizzerias are everywhere, but the pizza chains still dominate takeout and delivery. Domino's alone accounts for nearly 40% of delivery pizza sales in the U.S., on par with all regional chains and mom-and-pops combined. Perhaps these big companies are stifling real pizza box innovation. We have a solution for that, for the most part, delivers the hot product to a customer in a way that also works for our operations, Zach Hoffman, Domino's Director of Operations Innovations, told me. We haven't found a need to rethink it. And so we must find peace with this cursed container. Its simplicity is its value, and precisely why it's so hard to give up. Like a Christmas tree or a cast iron pan, what the pizza box lacks in perfect engineered function, it makes up for in familiarity, tradition, and populism. Your life is different from your grandparents, but this is quite literally your grandparents' pizza box. It is a custom that brings us together in a kind of communion, sogginess and all. There's no wealthy person version of the pizza box, Carol Helstoksky, a University of Denver professor and the author of Pizza, A Global History, told me, the pizza box is just the pizza box. The Hero Gen Z Needs by Elise Hannum. Snoopy was everywhere when I was growing up in the early 2000s. On TV, the cartoon beagle appeared as a float in Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and starred in the holiday specials my family watched. In real life, his statues were all over St. Paul, Minnesota, a hometown I share with the Peanuts creator Charles Schulz. After I left for college, Snoopy largely disappeared from my life. But recently, I've been encountering him all over again on social media. The TikTok account at Snoopy is Cool went viral earlier this year and has more than 500,000 followers. Other Snoopy videos on the app regularly rack up thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of views. This online resurgence, primarily among young people, has mostly been fueled by short, shareable Peanuts clips to surprisingly apt contemporary music. Snoopy has always been defined in part by how emotional he is. Some fans say that his personality speaks to their inner child. He plays pretend and dreams big while finding joy in little wins, such as receiving a full bowl of food. But Snoopy's grand feelings also reflect his existential side, a reminder of the comic's original gloomy tone, the perception of which has softened and sanitized over subsequent decades. It seems that a new generation is finally seeing Snoopy for who he is. Despite featuring an adorable dog and his rich fantasy life, Peanuts always had bleak philosophical themes. Snoopy, despite his broad imagination and silly antics, had personal troubles, too. Ball pointed to one edition of Peanuts where Snoopy cries on Mother's Day because he's separated from his mom. After helping him send her a card, Charlie Brown muses about how holidays can be difficult for everyone. When Schulz adapted his comics for the animated specials in the 1960s, Snoopy became more anthropomorphic and expressive, and embarked on his own fantastical B-plots. He didn't speak, instead communicating with noises, including whining and cackling. Still, his angst remained. Many of today's young people likely first experienced the Peanuts characters through the animated specials, which explains why those clips trigger a specific nostalgia. But the televised format also lends itself to TikTok. Unlike in the comics, Snoopy in animated form doesn't have thought bubbles to explain his feelings, so he resorts to over-the-top physicality. When a female poodle pecks him on the cheek, he blushes, his ears standing straight up. Then he falls into a swoon as cartoon hearts appear over his head. He sobs loudly at a party, but still takes comfort in a small moment of affection, a high five with a friend who is also crying. His ability to convey these sentiments, all without saying a word, might have a particular appeal for Zoomers, who have been performing big emotions online since they learned to type. The key to Snoopy's popularity now seems to go beyond his cuteness. Over the years, the character had been turned into a mascot for organizations such as MetLife and NASA. The Snoopy statues in my hometown, which I'd see in the airport, the library, my high school, serve both as a tribute to Schultz and as an adorable character for kids to admire. What rings especially true today, however, is the dog's tumultuous inner life. If the character's commodification has at times flattened him, his online rebirth in the Zoomer era emphasizes his emotional oscillation, making him feel truer to the original Peanuts and to today's realities. In Sarah Boxer's 2015 article on Snoopy's legacy, she describes his behavior as a defense mechanism. Since no one will ever see you the way you see yourself, you might as well build your world around fantasy. Create the person you want to be and live it out, live it up. As Zoomers come of age, they face a barrage of seemingly hopeless climate and political catastrophes. In the face of this, it's no wonder Snoopy has become a hero. Sometimes people just want to throw their hands up at the immensity of the world and retreat to a controlled interior one, a doghouse of their own, from which they can feel their emotions as much as they want. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.